judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Lieutenant Colonel Edsel D. Magnahaus, miscellaneous docket number 2016-10. Today, the issue presented for oral argument is whether the military judge abused his discretion in dismissing the charge and specification with prejudice based on a due process violation of the Fifth Amendment. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Very well. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I am Major Matt Osborne, and I, along with Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this matter. Congress's determination that rape, as well as murder, will have no statute of limitations displays how extremely important the prosecution of these cases is in our society. Rape victims suffer the consequences of the crime for a lifetime, and they have no time limit from which to report an offense against them, and no time limit to decide when they wish to cooperate with a case, even if they had previously refused cooperation. Placing manufactured time limits, as the military judge attempted to in his ruling in this case, creates a de facto statute of limitations on victims where none was provided by Congress, especially those who report but do not wish to pursue prosecution. This scenario, if unchallenged, amounts to a situation to where victims who report such assault allegations are then placed in the situation of having to cooperate now because we cannot prosecute later. Such a scenario is counter to sound public policy and the actions of Congress over the last two decades and is not the role of a trial judge to decide. So here the military judge abused his discretion in dismissing the charge and specification with prejudice when he created a de facto statute of limitations based on a due process violation of the Fifth Amendment by both making clearly erroneous findings of fact and incorrect conclusions of law. As such, this court should reverse the trial judge's action and return this case to the trial level. So at first, I'd like to address the military judge's conclusions of law in this case, which this court reviews de novo.
Counsel, but before you go down that way, I want to talk just quickly about facts that were found by the judge here. Did the government ask for reconsideration after the judge's ruling in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you agree that the government could have sought reconsideration of the judge's ruling at the trial level?
They could have, Your Honor.
Okay. And I guess the question I'm trying to bring up is that we sit here and we try to parse out what the judge said, what the judge meant. Is it not better, just for the process of this case, that we allow the judge, the trial judge, who can take the evidence to develop the record before it comes to this court? And reconsideration would have allowed the government or the appellee in this case to better develop the record.
It was certainly an option, Your Honor. I don't think in this case it would have mattered, particularly in light of the fact that the military judge here was ruling on two different motions at the time. He ruled first on the statute of limitations motion, which he denied, and then he ruled on his motion here as well. And frankly, you know, based on the record and the facts that were given at trial, I'm not sure a reconsideration motion would have gotten that much more out of the military judge, based on what he put in his findings of fact.
But one of the findings of fact that we're arguing about here on this appeal, in both the government's brief and the appellee's brief, is the meaning of whether or not she requested to go forward with the case early on or not. So could not the trial level been the better way of handling that? Or if not, is a better option for this court to now return the record to the trial judge to have him make a more expansive or extensive factual finding to aid this court in determining the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in his ruling, I will say in his findings of fact, he did note 40 different bullet points of findings of fact. So this wasn't a case of where we've got a military judge who puts in like a paragraph or two of his findings of fact. There are 40 different things he found, so it was certainly, you know, at least fleshed out in his mind. So again, You know, is that a possibility? Sure, but I think based on this record, we can certainly find, with the findings of fact, enough to make a ruling on this case.
Counsel, I will also notice, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Is that just quantity over quality?
Well,
in the sense that the alleged victim in this case did not testify at the third inmate, did she?
She did not, Your Honor.
Nor was an apparent video recording of her from the interview with CJS placed before the judge, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So a lot of information that she had was not made part of 39A.
That's correct. Right?
And so, as you point out, there's nothing in the record where she directly disputes the notion that she wasn't chomping at the bit to go forward, or she clearly said, I want to go forward. And leaves us wondering, you know, what she might have said if she'd been 39A, or what she might have said on that video, which we don't have, and neither did the judge for that matter.
Well, I think what we do have in the record that contradicts what the judge found is her statement from 1998, where she specifically says, I did not want to take any action because of the treatment other females had received after having come forward about being raped. In that same statement, she said, I did not want to come forward with an investigation due to the treatment of the corps and the administration to the females who do come forward with having been raped. So certainly in 1998, we have a statement from her explicitly saying, I didn't want to go forward. Which is then corroborated by the testimony of Captain Mackle, the SJA at the Coast Guard. But Senior Judge Zabriskie, the main part about sending it back just for more findings of fact is the findings of fact are certainly an issue here, but it's not the seminal issue. The seminal issue is his conclusion of law that this was a due process violation. And the reason he came up to that doesn't necessarily, at least with one part, namely the prejudice aspect of it, doesn't have anything to do with whether or not necessarily the victim wanted to or did not want to go forward at that point.
But you would agree it was significant to his findings as to whether or not the government's conduct in this case arose to the level that would result in a due process violation.
It was certainly in the aspect of the first prong with the delay aspect. But even in that part, the government argues, certainly in the brief and today as well, that it's not necessarily what she wanted at that time. It's, one, the SJA, the government's interpretation after interviewing her of how that case was going to go, certainly with his interpretation of her willingness to go forward, because, you know, the test for this egregious or intentional delay is that of by the government. So we've got to look at the government's reasons for not going forward back in 1998. So what we certainly have in the record is plenty of testimony from the SJA, from the captain, who was the SJA at the Coast Guard Academy at that time and essentially made the call on whether or not to go forward. But jumping back, though, to the conclusion of law about the due process violation. First, I want to start with the prejudice piece. And, of course, the burden here is on the appellee for both of these prongs, both the prejudice and the delay. It's their burden. It was their burden at trial, and now since this is a de novo review, they still have that burden, even though the United States is the appellant here. And so the test for prejudice was first laid out in United States versus Marion, a Supreme Court case, where they said that a defendant seeking to dismiss a charge on this ground must demonstrate, quote, that the delay caused, quote, substantial prejudice to his rights to a fair trial. And that's an important word there, substantial. Specifically, the court ruled there that the possibility of prejudice inherent in any extended delay, memories dimming, witnesses becoming inaccessible, evidence lost, is not in and of itself enough to demonstrate substantial prejudice. A few years later, Lovasco comes out from the Supreme Court as well, and they say actual prejudice is what's needed. Not speculation, not predictions, but actual prejudice, and that's a question of whether the accused is, quote, able to mount an effective defense. They also noted that the defense in that case, they ruled there was no due process violations in the case, even though the appellant defense might have been somewhat prejudiced by the lapse in time. So here, for prejudice, the standard is not a somewhat prejudice or a little bit of prejudice. It's a substantial prejudice that made the accused unable to mount an effective defense. So in his ruling, the military judge found prejudice because of the death of a witness and the diminished memories of other witnesses in the case. So as to the witness who died, and that is Ms. Moulton, the United States argues that her testimony was first speculation. Two, any testimony she would have provided was based on a collateral issue. And then three, even without her testimony, the appellee was still able to mount an effective defense. So it's first important to understand the exact nature of the testimony involved here. And this all came out of the victim's statement in 2014 to CGIS when she told them, quote, "I can't remember her last name. I went to cadet counseling. I think it was Moulton." And she was like, "Well, if you continue, this could look bad because they could say that you have a mental health issue and you may not be able to be commissioned." So she recommended that I don't continue counseling. So there, it's important to note that what the victim is saying, Ms. Moulton said, was not discouraging her from go to trial or don't go forward with this case. She was, according to the victim, it was a talk about counseling, about the rape allegation. And that goes to the first issue with all of this about Ms. Moulton, is that it's pure speculation, which goes against what the Supreme Court said in Levasco of we have to have actual prejudice, not speculation, something that was echoed by our Superior Court in U.S. v. Reed when they said that speculation by the defense is not sufficient. So here's the speculation. First, we're not even sure if Ms. Moulton was the right person that the victim talked to. She said, "I think it was Ms. Moulton." But even if it was, one, we're not sure if Ms. Moulton would even have remembered the victim. We're also not sure what Ms. Moulton would have actually said. The appellee seems to think that she would disagree with what the victim said, which was she discouraged me or she wanted me not to go through with the trial. But she just as likely could have said, "I usually recommend folks push through the process, but in this particular case with these circumstances, I recommended to her that she not." So the point of this is we have no idea what she would have said, which makes that certainly speculation.
Let's say the victim in this case would have told Mrs. Moulton all the details as to what happened to her with the appellant on that evening. Does she then become a relevant and a critical witness at that point? If she had relayed the incident that occurred between the appellee and the victim.
It's possible, but again, Your Honor, your question was predisposed with the word if, which is, again, the speculation that the Supreme Court said we can't have. At trial, what the military judge was looking at and what the defense was claiming is that she was going to impeach the victim because in 2014 the victim said, she quote-unquote discouraged me from going to trial, which if you actually look at the statement that was made from the victim to CGIS, she never said anything about being discouraged, quote-unquote. What she said was she recommended that I don't continue counseling. That's all that we're talking about. But even if it is exactly how the appellee says it is, and Ms. Moulton would have testified and said, "I didn't discourage her from that," that doesn't necessarily place in contradiction anything that the victim said. I mean, what we're talking about here is in 1998, Ms. Moulton, who would recall a conversation where she acknowledged, the intent to prepare a victim for what could come as a result of a rape allegation report. Where the victim might see that as maybe discouraging her, which again is not even what she said, Ms. Moulton could very well have said, "That's exactly what I said to her about the issues and mental health challenges and the ability to graduate and all of these things, but I did it in effect to tell her the realities of what's going to happen, not necessarily to discourage her from doing anything." But all of this comes back to the bigger issue is all of this is pure speculation across the board.
I just want to clarify one issue. One of the statements that was submitted as part of the motion practice was from the victim where she stated, "I also talked to one of the cadet counselors, Pamela Moulton, about the incident." So when we talk about if or speculative, I mean, there's at least some evidence before the court that, in fact, she did speak to her about the incident. Now,
to what details she spoke to her.
Correct.
But, again, I think it's a little bit more than just a speculative assessment on behalf of this court that she, at least in her own statement, said she had a conversation with her about what occurred.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm not saying there's speculation as to whether or not there was counseling that was done. The speculation is to the substance of that, and that's where we don't know what that substance is, and even if that would either go in favor of the appellee or in favor of the United States. Because theoretically, if Ms. Moulton did testify and said, I did tell her about all of these issues that would come about, but I told her that not to discourage her, but to let her know the realities of the situation, that would actually not go against and could actually be detrimental to the defense's case, as opposed to
more what the victim said to Ms. Moulton, not what Ms. Moulton said back to the victim. So we're talking about prejudice here. So the victim relays a completely different story as to what she put into her statements. Then that's kind of the issue that I'm getting at as to prejudice.
Yes,
and whether or not Mrs. Moulton could have relayed a consistent or an inconsistent statement with regard to what the victim reported occurred between she and the appellee in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I'll just say again one, it goes to the conversation they had about whether or not they wanted to go forward with the case as opposed to the actual substance of the issue. And it goes back to, Ms. Moulton was not an eyewitness to this crime. She was not a star witness to either the defense or the prosecution. As the appellee actually said in his unsworn statement at the Article 32, this was a he said, she said thing. In the victim's statement, she said, we were in a room by ourselves, no one heard anything, no one did anything. So this was not someone who witnessed a murder or was taking part in any kind of action.
Well, counsel, and doesn't her credibility become a critical issue at trial?
Her credibility absolutely does. Well, the victim's credibility does. But the main point here is that Ms. Moulton was not the only witness to go against the credibility. We had multiple other witnesses to do that. One was at the Article 32, and that's the 06, the SJA, who could talk about whether or not he discouraged her from going to trial. There's also two other witnesses, one being Commander Pitts, who was a friend of the victim's back in 1998 at the Coast Guard Academy, who in her declaration said, I don't recall the victim ever telling me anything about a rape, even though the victim said, I told her the next day about the rape. Now, what's interesting is about Commander Pitts is that the military judge doesn't mention Commander Pitts at all in his ruling. Certainly when we're talking about prejudice and the ability to mount an effective defense. Another witness to talk about credibility and certainly this idea that she was discouraged from going to trial is Lieutenant Smalsey, who was the second legal officer in the SJA's office at the Coast Guard Academy. He was the first person the victim ever talked to about any of this stuff. Again, the military judge was silent as to Lieutenant Smalsey when we were talking about whether or not the appellant's ability to mount an effective defense was prejudiced. And this also comes back down to the third part of the argument about Ms. Moulton, is whether or not whether or not the appellee was able to mount an effective defense. And I would ask this court to look at the Article 32 and the evidence that was submitted there by appellee's counsel. There, they brought multiple witnesses and had 22 declarations that testified about the appellee's good character, character for truthfulness and peacefulness, including three former or current Air Force commanders. They also had declarations about the victim's general character and character for truthfulness and in the impeachment of the victim's recitation of facts. So here, this is not as if the time has passed and the defense is now left with no case whatsoever. This is certainly, they had the ability, they don't have the ability, but they did mount an effective defense at the Article 32, and there's nothing to show that they wouldn't be able to do the same at a court-martial. So that is the part on the prejudice piece, and I'd now very quickly like to move to the delay part of the aspect of this. And it's important here, and I go in my brief a little bit, I won't go through the whole thing now, about the disagreement that certainly the government has with the trial judge in terms of what the proper test is here. You know, in Reed, we have that the court says, quote-unquote, most of the federal courts relying on Lovasco and Marion have held that the defendant has the burden of proof to show an egregious or intentional tactical delay and actual prejudice. All right. They also said that, quote unquote, it's a due process violation when it's incurred in reckless disregard of the circumstances known to the prosecution, suggesting that there existed an appreciable risk that delay would impair the ability, again, to mount an effective defense. So the government's argument, and certainly that is in tune with 10 of the 12 federal courts, and also that what was held by the Supreme Court in Lovasco and Marion, is that the test is an intentional delay by the government. That's the test. When you look at, you know, even in Reed, when they say, quote unquote, most of the federal courts have held, well, 10 of the 12 federal courts hold that in addition to actual prejudice, you have to have an intentional delay, not an egregious delay or an intentional delay. All the 10 of the 12 courts say is intentional delay. And then if you look at U.S. v. Vogan, and again, I mentioned this in my brief, on how the word egregious came about, because keep in mind the Supreme Court never mentioned the word egregious in either Lovasco or Marion. Caff is the first one who brought up the word egregious, and that was in U.S. v. Vogan, and that was in a sentence right after they quoted Lovasco about tactical delay. So, you know, it's certainly unclear what is, you know, the true test here. But the government submits that the test here is that the government, that the appellee has to prove an intentional delay, not just an egregious delay.
Well, counsel, have you had a chance to review Bedeman versus Montana, which is a Supreme Court case from this past May? The issue there was whether the Sixth Amendment applied in the post-trial phase or not. And as they went through that decision, they broke down the whole process between what the pre-charging phase, the trial itself, and post-trial. And in there, they talking about the pre-trial phase was that due process clause may be violated, for instance, by a prosecutor delay that is tactical or reckless. So they've pointed out tactical or reckless. And so my question is, in light of that case where Justice Ginsburg says that, how do you square that with what you said so far? In other words, I would read your perspective to be that it has to be intentional tactical delay, that egregious only modifies intentional or tactical.
And, Your Honor, and that language goes also with what Caff said in Reed when they said that was incurred in a reckless disregard. So we've got that reckless language throughout. But when we're talking about egregious, you know, reckless, intentional is kind of the all-in-one encompassing thing. So with the intentional delay, obviously, if that's the rule, then everyone agrees that there was no intentional tactical delay on behalf of the government. But even if egregious is the rule, and if the court wants to find that, there's still simply no showing of egregious by the government in this case.
Let's talk about that real quick. Would you agree that the government's handling of this allegation was abnormal?
Was abnormal.
I'll use that word. There's probably better words I could use, a little more harsh. But would you agree that the government and the fact that this victim came forward with an allegation, we have no evidence that any law enforcement agency engaged in a significant or thorough investigation of the allegation, that somehow reported or documented what occurred, so if the victim did decide later on to come forward, in fact, they would have had evidence, i.e. maybe a statement from Commander Pitts as to what she remembered close in time to the allegation. But instead, we have an SJ sticking a sheet of paper in a folder and saying, hey, we'll call it a day. So I guess my question here, how do you look at the government's investigation or the government's handling, considering that's one of the issues we're going to look at, is the government's conduct or misconduct in the handling of this?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And certainly by today's standard, it would be abnormal. But we're talking about 1998, which is before there's Article 6B rights and before there's a such thing as restricted versus unrestricted reporting and the whole host of sexual assault kind of mandates that have come since that time.
But we still investigated allegations.
Well, absolutely.
And here there doesn't appear to be any evidence, in fact, that it was done. And I guess a second question I want to follow on is the fact that you had two allegations against the appellee in this case of sexual assault. It seems, again, I'll use the word abnormal, that the government appeared to take no action to try to document
when you at least had allegations there was a serial offender running around the Coast Guard Academy.
Yes, Your Honor. So according to the testimony from Captain Mackle, when she came, you know, at that point there was the statement that she had already made that said she did not want to go forward. And from the conversation he had with her, from his testimony, that's again under oath, and this is from a retired 06 JAG who's still a civil servant who's been serving the government for 40 years, he says she did not want to go forward. And it's interesting to note that the party at trial, thank you, that was trying to nail down exactly what the victim said was the appellee's counsel, who, you know, Captain Mackle said, you know, she went through, even said kind of during cross-examination that she wasn't chomping at the bit to go. Appellee's counsel then got up and said, well, what do you mean by that? Do you mean like she kind of was on the fence and you kind of pushed her one way? Or did that mean that she did not want to go forward? And he said she absolutely did not want to go forward. So at least, again, in the government's eye, we had a witness who, in a statement that was written, said, I don't want to go forward. And then we have a testimony from a retired JAG who said, she told me she didn't want to go forward. And here, in this case, this was not a case of where we had a loss. And, Your Honor, I see my time is up. If I could finish real quick. This is not a case, going back to the prejudice, where there's some loss of evidence, where there's some DNA or there's, you know, bed sheets or eyewitnesses or any of that stuff. This was going to be a strictly he said, she said case. And at that point, what the government had was a witness who, in its eyes, based on the evidence they had before him, did not want to go forward in a prosecution. And so that is why they took the action that they did. But yet the military judge says that it was that much more egregious that he didn't do anything, even in the face of that. And, Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of my time subject to any more questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, please, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I have just 1 second, please?
Yes.
May it please the court, counsel for the government, good morning. The military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion when he granted this motion. He saw an 18-year period of government inaction, over 7,000 days, with no notice to Lieutenant Colonel Mangahas that he was under suspicion of any misconduct, zero investigation, no charging decision by a convening authority, nothing, complete inaction from 1998 to 2014. And I know the court is aware of the standard, but I feel better just repeating it out loud, that the court is supposed to consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, which is Lieutenant Colonel Mangahas. So if there's any dispute, we're supposed to get the benefit of the doubt. And the military judge only abuses his discretion if his findings are clearly erroneous, his decision is influenced by an incorrect view of the law, or his decision is outside the range of reasonable choices available to him based on the facts and the law. We would respectfully submit there's no need to remand this case for further fact-finding. I've been practicing military justice for a long time, and I've never seen a military judge's ruling so thorough, so thoughtful, and so complete. And the fact that he listened to the evidence and made some credibility decisions and made some calls on facts, that was within his discretion, and we would respectfully submit that this court should make a ruling based on the facts that are in the record right now, because they're sufficient to support our position, we believe.
Okay, and one of the government's arguments is the judge was clearly erroneous in basically ruling that the victim did not want to go forward back in 1997, 1998. So what facts were put before the military judge that supports that finding?
Excellent question, Your Honor. And there are facts, but as a preliminary matter, our contention with respect is that is not an essential finding relevant to the issue in this case. So that's my first answer. It doesn't matter whether she wanted to go forward or not. And so whether the court agrees or disagrees with the judge's finding on that issue is not dispositive of the case. However, to answer your question, Your Honor, There was a conflict in the testimony. The evidence is not clear one way or the other, and that's what I was getting to a moment ago with the standard of review. There is evidence that in February, when the complaining witness alleges that she was raped, she made the decision not to go forward. Then she changed her mind in the springtime. It's very clear from her written statement. Again, I hate to admit that, her written statement. For purposes of trial, we're not going to concede that. But for purposes of today, that's her written statement that she says she made in April of 97. There's evidence it was made in 1998. So there's a conflict in the evidence. The evidence doesn't have to be conflict-free. The military judge is entrusted with the discretion to sift through all the evidence and make an intelligent decision about what happened or what's most likely to have happened. So the evidence is in February she didn't want to go forward. She changed her mind in the spring. She did want to go forward. And then she, again, still wanted to go forward in November. She went back and reengaged with the SJA's office. What's going on with this case?
Counsel, can you point in the statement where she says she wants to go forward? I mean, I've read the statement, and I'm not sure that that's in there. Are you inferring that from the statement?
The written statement, Your Honor?
Yes.
No, it's not in there. It's in the fact, it's in her videotaped statement to CGIS, the hour and a half video, which was the only evidence the government put on at the Article 32, which I'll talk about the Article 32 later with regard to prejudice. But she's very clear, and you have a transcript of it, or at least an excerpt. I didn't realize that the whole Article 32 evidence, all the exhibits weren't before the court, but we did provide an excerpt of her, of the transcript of that interview. I believe it's attachment 3 to our motion. And in that, she makes it very clear that she was interested in pursuing this case as late as November, December of 97 when she asked the SJA, what happened to my statement? And the government relies on that written statement, but there's no evidence that Captain Mackle, the SJA, ever saw it. If you look carefully at her timeline, she says she gave that written statement to Lieutenant Solmacy, who was the deputy. She never says she gave it to Captain Mackle. In fact, she says when she goes back to the SJA's office in November, they tell her that they've lost her statement. So what would a prudent person do in that situation? She testifies, or she states to CGIS that that statement was saved on her hard drive at that time. Do they ask her to go print another copy? No. They didn't do anything. And so there's no evidence that the SJA was even aware of that written statement. And so I think the military judge was free to decide upon this conflicting evidence. Did she want to go forward? Did she not want to go forward? It doesn't matter. He picked what he thought was the most logical finding, and his finding is supported by the record. It's not clearly erroneous. And, again, as I say, it's not an essential relevant fact to this court's disposition anyway. And again, everyone knows this is not a consent case. The defense here is that this didn't happen at all, and therefore impeachment of the complaining witness is the paramount issue. And I think throughout the government's brief and even a little bit in argument today, the government focuses on taking issue with facts that aren't relevant to this court's disposition of the case. The important things for this court to look at is, what did the government know, when did they know it, and what did they do about it? Those are what the court should be looking at, in my view. At issue here is the government's conduct, not the complaining witness's conduct. The government kind of wants to shift the whole blame for the delay in this case to the complaining witness. And with all due respect, that's just an erroneous view of the facts and the law. This is about the officials at the Coast Guard Academy, not only the deputy SJA and the SJA, but the board members of the executive hearing who heard her testimony that she'd been raped the year before. She names by name her company officer. She says she disclosed to him by name that she was raped. And then the whole counselor business, which we'll talk about the prejudice from the death of Pam Moulton. Those people all share some blame. But what I really want to focus on today is above and beyond the Coast Guard Academy officials, who's really at blame here is the law enforcement agents whose job it is to investigate allegations of crime. The Coast Guard Investigative Service had in its possession as early or as late as January of 1998 a written, signed, sworn statement from this witness saying, I was raped last year. There's no evidence that they asked her a single question. Really, you were raped? Who? What? Where? When? How? And I would refer the court to the motion that we filed, the motion to dismiss for speedy trial, and the factual recitation that it contains. And then refer you to the record from the motions hearing where the government stipulates to the accuracy of each and every one of those facts. Those are the facts the military judge relied on. With respect, those are the facts that are binding on this court. The government has admitted that they're true. And in there, you'll see there was zero. It's not just, well, we don't know if they did an investigation because there's no evidence. This government has stipulated that there was no investigation by anyone, Coast Guard officials, CGIS, whose job it is to do that. This was an abysmal handling of this case. And I feel terrible for the complaining witness that her case was handled badly. But my job is to make sure that Lieutenant Colonel Mangahas's due process rights are protected. And they, after 20 years, they just weren't. So again, the complaining witness has the right to not participate. She has a right to express her preference to the convening authority, what she'd like to see happen with the case. She does not have the authority to put a kibosh on the investigation. Again, she named names. Why didn't somebody go talk to the company officer, talk to Pamela Moulton, talk to Commander Pitts, then cadet? Why didn't anyone talk to these people and document what, when things were fresh in people's minds, what happened or what didn't happen? Why didn't they talk to the people who lived on the hallway where this happened, supposedly? Why didn't they look for forensic evidence? The government says there's no forensic evidence. She says in her written statement, which she doesn't say in her video statement, by the way, but in her written statement, she talks about after the alleged rape, he sat on her bed and masturbated until he ejaculated. In fact, she says it hit her, and the shoulder was very traumatizing to her. She couldn't get clean enough after her shower. There's forensic evidence that could and should have been found, or at least explored. Government did none of that. None of that. And CGIS is to blame, and the Coast Guard's to blame. The government is to blame. It's not up to the complaining witness to direct or stop an investigation. There's not even a note in a file, hey, complaining witness doesn't want to play. They just did nothing. And that's a due process violation after this long of a time, Your Honors. And I would focus on the fact that there was an even greater, not only incentive, but requirement for the government to investigate this case, considering the context. This is a cadet at a military academy, a future commissioned officer in our armed forces. There is an institutional interest in making sure that before we put a commission on someone's shoulder, that they earned it and they deserve it. And they had an obligation to look into this allegation, and they failed to do that. They didn't, and most importantly, in addition to not preserving all this other evidence, guess who else they didn't talk to? They didn't talk to Lieutenant Colonel then Cadet Mangahas. He had no idea he was under suspicion of such a serious offense. He had no opportunity to be put on, either make a statement or not. Perhaps more importantly, to preserve evidence. What if he were out of town the weekend that she says this happened? 20 years later, it's impossible to prove that. At the time, he could have said, I couldn't have done that. Here's where I was. And I'm not saying that happened. I'm saying they should have, at a minimum, put him on notice. Hey, do you know that this fellow cadet has accused you of this awful thing? What do you have to say about that? They didn't even put, he had no idea for almost 20 years that he was suspected of rape.
Counsel, just the government in their brief at least suggests there are certain tests that this court should apply with regard to the Fifth Amendment violation. Or it can be an argument as to whether the judge applied the egregious and or tactical, intentional tactical delay, or whether the judge just applied a delay, that the length of time in and in itself was sufficient to cause a due process violation. What is the appellee's theory as to what test this court should apply?
Sir, the test comes from United States versus Reed, which is our Superior Court's case from 1995. It is clear and it is unambiguous. The language is plain. It says that in order to prove a violation, you have to prove two things. One, an egregious or tactical delay, and two, prejudice. We all agree we have to prove prejudice, and we'll get to that in a second. But on the first prong, the government didn't say until the motion's hearing at trial that it was egregious and tactical. But that's what they argued at the hearing. And the judge and the counsel, we all discussed it at great length, I'm sure you saw. And the judge made the decision to apply the plain language of the CAF's holding and read that says egregious or intentional. And the government argued at trial that, well, egregious and tactical are equivalent. They're synonyms. And I respectfully disagree. I think a delay for a tactical reason is always going to be egregious, but an egregious delay could be something other than for a tactical purpose. And I think in this case, just the length of time and the fact that the government had so much information at its fingertips and did nothing with it, those, it's not just the length, although the length over 7,000 days is an egregious excessive. Let's look at what egregious means. If you look at egregious up in the dictionary, it says shockingly bad, shockingly negative, or flagrant. And a 17-year delay is shockingly bad with respect. And above and beyond the delay, you have a complete inaction during that time. They're not investigating, like in Lovasco. Lovasco was only an 18-month delay, and they were investigating the whole time. That's why there was no due process violation. Marion, there was only a 3-year delay.
But counsel, don't the cases also say to go back and look at the reason for the delay, which doesn't that put back into play the importance of the perspective of the complainant in this case and her willingness or not willingness to go forward? When you go back and judge whether or not that was a reasonable exercise of discretion by the SJ or any prosecutor faced with what he may have viewed as a reluctant witness.
Yes, sir, I agree that it's a consideration. It's not the dispositive consideration because, again, as I said, she had the option to give an interview, not give an interview, participate, not participate. She didn't have the authority to say, you can't talk to anyone else. You can't come take pictures of my room. You can't get the forensic evidence that exists. You can't check for security camera footage. She didn't have authority to stop an investigation or even stop a prosecution. And my view is the convening authority had the obligation to determine what are the facts and make an informed charging decision. And he very well may have said, well, because she doesn't want to testify, maybe I won't go forward. But that's not what happened. That's what should have happened. They should have done an investigation, and there should have been an informed charging decision, not just let her run the show. She doesn't have veto power. She has input then and now. Even now, the DOD instruction says the complaining witness should be advised that she doesn't have to participate, but that doesn't stop the investigation. And it wasn't formalized back then in the same words, but it's the same concept. I was a trial counsel back in the 90s. It's terrible. It's difficult to prosecute a case when your complaining witness doesn't want to play. I get that. But it doesn't mean you don't see what other evidence is out there to determine the strength or weakness of the case. And there's no evidence that the convening authority even made a decision in this case, which was his obligation to do. So egregious, over 7,000 days, the statute of limitations is irrelevant. I disagree with the government that this is a de facto statute of limitations. The military judge, they made that argument at trial. Well, it's within the statute of limitations. By definition, it's not egregious. I disagree. All of the cases, Marion, Lovasco, they all talk about that even when a case is brought within the statute of limitations, the Fifth Amendment due process protection kicks in. You can still have a due process violation, even if the statute of limitations is not violated. I think the judge's finding that the delay was egregious is supported by the record. It's not clearly erroneous, and as far as whether it's considered a conclusion of law, it's supported by a very thoughtful and careful analysis of the controlling authority. It's correct. This judge did his job. He did his homework. And this court should uphold it. It was certainly within the range of reasonable choices based on the law and the facts. Now, let's talk about prejudice. The government takes the military judge to task for citing post-trial delay cases, Haney specifically, for determining whether a delay was egregious or whether there was prejudice. And with all due respect, the government in its motion, its answer to our motion at trial, applied the Barker versus Wingo Sixth Amendment cases. The government on appeal says that the judge was wrong because he conflated the Fifth and Sixth Amendment standards, and he talked about post-trial versus pre-trial, and they're different. And with all due respect, they're just wrong. At trial, everybody, and look at Haney, look at Moreno, and there's even another 2006 case, which I don't believe is in the briefs, the Tui case from CAF. They all apply the Sixth Amendment structure. And the government cites in its brief to the Moreno decision. They cite to page 149 for the proposition that prejudice at pretrial levels is different than prejudice post-trial, and we completely agree. But if you continue to read, first of all, that language appears in the dissent. But I agree with it. There is a difference in prejudice when you're pretrial and you're preparing for trial versus post-trial and you're already convicted. The prejudice is greater in the pretrial context, and the court says that. Judge Crawford in her dissent says that once you're convicted, your prejudice level goes down. You have to really show something extreme to show prejudice in the post-trial context. In the pre-trial context, there's a lot more potential for prejudice. So I wanted to point that out to the court. But as far as the actual prejudice, the judge found we proved actual prejudice, and his finding is correct, and here's why. Witnesses, it's uncontroverted, Captain Mackle and Commander Pitts both said their memory had dimmed after that much time. There was, as I've discussed, a complete lack of physical evidence that could and should have been preserved from the time. So there's forensics, her written statement, fact witnesses who shouldn't have been in, and it's completely impossible at this late stage to go back and reconstruct all that. But obviously, we want to focus on the death of a very key witness. As we said, this he said, she said, credibility is key. And Pamela Moulton not only would impeach her, the complaining witness, on a very key subject. It's not a collateral matter whether she wanted to go forward or not in terms of trying the case. Okay, it is a collateral matter for the point of the speedy trial motion. But if we lose and we have to go back and try this case, whether she wanted, what she said to Pamela Moulton is very important. And we've lost the opportunity to ask Pamela Moulton what the complaining witness told her. And again, I don't believe we have to show egregious and tactical. But in the alternative, if the court disagrees with me and you think we have to show some sort of mental culpability state on the part of the government, even the cases the government cites, and even CAF has mentioned negligence, would satisfy that prong. And we've alleged from day one that the government was grossly negligent in their handling of this case. They knew as early, according to the complaining witness, they knew as early as 1998 that Pamela Moulton was a witness. Nobody talked to her then. They knew in October of 2014 that she was a key witness. They didn't talk to her then. They talked to her in December, 2 months later. They didn't ask her a single question about this case, not one question. Government stipulates that fact. I'm not speculating. Then she dies before the 32. So no one has a chance ever to ask her these questions, which would have a huge bearing on the trial of this case if it goes to trial.
Can you specifically state what the critical evidence she would have provided?
Yes, sir. She would say, we have a good faith based on evidence that is in the record, that she never would have discouraged a cadet from continuing counseling.
And where does that evidence come from?
It comes from the testimony of Captain Mackle, the SJA, who says that Ms. Moulton was the person on campus at the Coast Guard Academy that was most vocal about protecting sex assault
victims. And I understand that part. In the victim's statements, it says she talked to Mrs. Moulton, and Mrs. Moulton dispersed her because of continuing counseling that could impact her ability. Not whether or not to go forward or not, but whether or not she should continue counseling and the mental health consequences that may come to that versus her commission. So there seems to be at least a discrepancy in the facts between what the victim has stated and what you're saying a witness that did make the statement say.
Yes, sir. Okay, so first of all, I believe Pamela Moulton would have said, I never told her to discontinue counseling. I set up the support group to support people who claim to be victims of sex assault. They need all the counseling they can get. I never would have said come once and don't come back again. That makes no sense. That's not logical. And Captain Mackle knew this woman well. They worked in the same office. Her physical office was across the hall from his, and they spoke every day. He said that's not something she would say. Her whole mission there was to help sex assault victims. She wouldn't have discouraged someone from counseling. And I think then it's a logical inference to argue she also would not have discouraged someone from proceeding with the case either. But if you want to just limit it to the discrete issue at trial, if this were to go to trial, the complaining witness would say, I told Pamela Moulton I needed counseling, and she told me I could only come one time. Otherwise, it would be bad for my career. Then we would call Pamela Moulton and say, I most certainly did not tell her that. That goes to the complaining witness's credibility. This is a he said, she said case. As the military judge found, credibility of this witness, this complaining witness, is the only issue, really, in this case. And Pamela Moulton would have directly contradicted her, and Colonel Mangahas had a Sixth Amendment right to confront and cross-examine his accuser. And because of the government's gross negligence and the lapse of time that was egregious, he is prevented from doing that because of the government's action. I also thought it was very perceptive of the military judge to find that Ms. Moulton would be a pertinent witness at sentencing, God forbid there was a conviction in this case. Because you know at sentencing, victim impact is a matter in aggravation, and you know that the government would call her as a witness in sentencing to say how terrible her life has been. You can look at what she tells the CGIS in October of 2014. She said, this ruined my life. I got negative OERs because of this. I was in my room crying all the time. I can't get promoted because I was raped when I was a cadet. So what she told Ms. Moulton about this rape certainly is important with regard to sentencing. And it would, if contradicted her, it would be an important piece of evidence for the members to consider. And then finally, it's interesting that the Haney case and some of the other CAF cases talk about, in addition to actual prejudice to the accused, the court can consider the negative effect on the public perception of the fairness of the military justice system. And how is that going to look to the public that the Coast Guard Investigative Service and officials at the Coast Guard Academy are on notice in writing with a sworn written statement that I was raped last year and they did nothing about it. And then 20 years later, without telling the man that he's accused, 20 years later, we're going to bring you to a felony court martial and take away your retirement. The man has 18 years of service. Outstanding service, I'll say. And so that brings me to the 32. I really think it's unfair for the government to argue that because we, quote, unquote, won the Article 32, that we haven't been prejudiced. That's just apples and oranges, Your Honors. The government didn't call a single witness at the Article 32. They put the video on, that's it. They didn't put their full case on. The standards are different. We didn't put our full case on. We don't have a full case yet because of the lapse of time. We can't get all the witnesses that we need. But we did the best with what we had. That's my duty as a defense counsel. Of course I called character witnesses. I had nothing else to do. I'm deprived of calling all the fact witnesses that would have contradicted her because of the lapse of time, because of the government's inaction. We're deprived of all the non-character evidence that existed at the time that no longer exists. So the fact that we, and oh, by the way, there was a finding of no probable cause, but guess what? The case got referred to trial anyway. So we have been prejudiced by the loss of evidence. We have been prejudiced by the delay. We have been prejudiced by the gross negligence of the government. The perception of the military justice system's fairness has been prejudiced. So the fact that there was a finding of no probable cause does not mean that our ability to defend this case is not prejudiced. Now, in conclusion, unless there's other questions, military judge did not abuse his discretion. His findings of fact are all supported by, on the essential issues especially, but I don't think he made any findings of fact that aren't supported by the record. But at least, if you had an quibble about this or that, it needs to be a fact of relevance to the issue of speedy trial. And with regard to those, about who knew what, when, and what they did about it, those are the important issues. He's right on the money. Everything is supported by the record, and he did not abuse his discretion. His conclusions of law, I know this court's not bound by them, but again, thoughtful, careful consideration of the case law, those civilian cases that the government cites and wants, the government's asking this court to look behind the plain language of Reed and say, well, this is what they really meant. You know, lawyers and judges use words for a living. If CAF had wanted to say egregious and tactical, they could have said that. But they didn't. They said or. And other CAF cases and cases from this court have cited that language out of Reed a number of times. And the word they use is or. And the Coast Guard Academy, Court of Criminal Appeals and the Navy and Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals also. There's not been any military case to say that Reed's language is wrong. It's binding. Thank you. Binding on this court, and it doesn't matter what the civilians say. It matters what the civilians say if there's an unsettled question of law and there's no military case on point. But the fact that the Third Circuit or the Seventh Circuit or some other civilian court says you have to prove a tactical, intentional delay is not binding on this court. What's binding on this court is Reed. And all the other cases that we've cited in our brief. And the military judge was correct when he read RCM 707-D1 that says if you find a constitutional deprivation, the only remedy is dismissal with prejudice. And that's what he did. So his findings of fact are not clearly erroneous. They're supported by the record. His analysis of the law is correct, and we would ask even under a de novo review that this court find that the delay was egregious, not just the length, but the length, considering the government's negligence and what they didn't do when they should have done it, that was egregious. And that Lieutenant Colonel Mangas has been prejudiced. His constitutional right was violated, and this court should deny the government's appeal. Any questions? I don't think I've ever sat down before my time was up before.
No, I have one more question. So
yes, sir.
You may not get there. Following up on Judge Brown's question about the victim's statement that she wanted to go forward. I just wanted to make sure I'm clear on that. You stated that was offered in the Article 32 testimony. And I want to make sure that I have my notes right, but there was something in the Article 32 that related that the victim made a statement that she didn't want to, or that she did want to go forward at some point.
Yes, sir. And what I'm referring to, the evidence specific, is her videotaped statement to CGIS in October 2014. It's an hour and a half long, and she goes through the timeline twice with the agent. And she says, it happened in February. I didn't want to go forward. When I found out some other information in the springtime, in April, May, I changed my mind. I made a written statement. I went over to the SJ's office. I turned it in. Only saw the deputy SJ. who wasn't at the 32, by the way, he was out of the country, but the fact that he was there or not there is not a dispositive fact for this court on this issue. But that's the evidence, Your Honor, that she did want to go forward in the spring. She also wanted to go forward in the fall of 97. She says, she claims that Colonel Meng has phoned her in November, which he denies. But for purposes of the motion, he phoned her. She found out he was contemplating or in the Air Force, and that made her mad because she was under the impression he wasn't going to be able to join the military. So she goes back to the SJA's office. What's going on with this case? How come he's allowed to join the military? What are we doing here? Clearly expressing an intent to go forward with her case. And that's the first time that she says, well, then the SJA told me maybe I won't get to my ship on time and all that. And again, she...
Are you inferring that again, or does she actually say, I'm willing to go forward? Are you inferring that from her actions in going back to the SJA's office to find out why this... Because she, at least according to some of the statements, believes the case is closed because he's not allowed to get his commission.
There's this conflict.
Are you inferring that she's willing to go forward, or does she actually say in the interview?
No, she doesn't say it explicitly, Your Honor.
I'm inferring that.
She takes action. She says, wait a second, where's my statement? Like, what relevance would her statement have if she didn't want someone to use it for something? She wanted to know, where's my statement? How come this is going on and nothing's happening to him? To me, that's a logical inference from the evidence that she wanted to go forward at that point, and I will concede that she got dissuaded, according to her. Again, if this goes to trial, we're going to contest all that, because Captain Mackle says, absolutely not, I never dissuaded her. But for purposes, the government's stuck with the evidence as it is right now in this motion, and the evidence is, at best, there's a conflict. She did want to go forward, she didn't want to go forward, and so the military judge was free to choose among those reasonable choices and make a finding of fact that's supported by the record, and it is. But again, that her desire to go forward or not go forward is not a dispositive issue for this court. It's what did the government do or what did the government not do? And they could have, if that's why they didn't do something, they could have documented it. Could have done a non-prosecution letter. They could have opened an investigation, say, well, we're not going to talk to anyone because she doesn't want us to. And then we'd have a whole different facts to argue about whether that was reasonable, because it wouldn't be. But they didn't even take that small step to document what her desires were. So 20 years later, we're trying to parse through all these conflicting statements, and that's why we trust military judges to make findings of fact, because they are there to on the front lines. And with respect, we argue that the judge got it right. He got it right on the facts, he got it right on the law, and his holding should stay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor, and there's a lot to get through in 5 minutes. First, in my opening argument, I argued that the focus was on the government actions in this case. In fact, I said that the test from Reed was no matter, you know, the circuit or the delay was egregious or intentional tactical delay by the government, and the focus of the delay should be on why the government felt it should not prosecute in 98. That's what I said in my brief. That's what I said in the first part of the argument. So any indication from the appellee that that's not what we're focused on is just not correct. Now, to the government, it certainly is important to see what the SJA, his interpretation of the victim's willingness to go forward. So when it says it doesn't matter if she wanted to go forward or not, what does matter is his interpretation of whether or not she wanted to go forward. And the appellee said, you know, what the government should have done, what they failed to answer, which I disagree with, is, you know, what did they know, when did they know it, and what did they do? So what did they know? In 1998, the SJA knew that he had a statement from a victim who said, I don't want to go forward. He also had a meeting from the victim where he testified. She was very explicit. And again, in testimony that appellee at trial made sure was specifically said, all right, did she kind of not want to go forward, or did she, no kidding, not want to go forward? The appellee is the one who got that testimony out of the SJA. And what happened? He said she definitely did not want to go forward. And I'll say, look at attachment 3 that appellee referenced. Look at that transcript of what she told CGIS that she told the legal office. And you will see exactly what the captain was faced with, and that was with an unwilling victim. I mean, you will see that her concern there was more on her own well-being, her future, as opposed to wanting to prosecute. The evidence shows the victim was concerned about the impact to her graduation, her assignment, and her career. And this was at a time before there was Article 6B rights, before there was an expedited transfer program, before there were SVCs. These were worries to her. So that's what the SJA had. So when did he know it? 1998, of course. And so what did he do? Based on that, he made, a, you know, based on his knowledge of the law, I've got a case that is a he said, she said, and I have a witness, I have a victim who does not want to go forward. And the military judge at trial certainly did not agree with that. He did not agree with that decision not to go forward or not to do anything. But Lovasco specifically says that's exactly what trial judges aren't supposed to do. The prosecutors have the decision. The government has that decision. So there's simply not any evidence that this decision rose to some kind of level of egregiousness, and that the military judge, he didn't even mention in his findings and his conclusions how this delay caused a reckless disregard that, again, was known to the government that this would somehow impair the appellee's ability to mount a defense, which is the prejudice prong. So that's where we are on that. You know, the other part that the appellee talks about is, you know, they're not bound by the wishes. You know, the victim doesn't make the decision. We absolutely agree. We actually say that in our brief as well. It's the prosecutor's, it's the government's decision to do that. But to think that that's not impacted, especially in a he said, she said case, by the willingness of a victim, I mean, you know, this is not anything that's outside of the norm. You know, we have prosecution discretion. We have ADA standards that say, we should look at the reluctance of a victim to testify. As a practical matter, the willingness of a victim to testify is certainly going to impact the evaluation of their case to do that.
Sorry to interrupt you. What about the government's duty to investigate this? I mean, it's fine that we say we're not, it's fine that the 06 says I'm not going to prosecute. I decided not to prosecute. I decided not to go forward. But that doesn't relieve them of the duty to investigate it, correct?
Well, when in this particular case, when we, the appellee also talked about physical evidence and not investigating for that. All right, when this was actually brought forth, this was months and months and months after this happened. So the idea that there's physical evidence out there, again, speculation on that. So what we're faced with is when, you know,
what
this SJ is told
at the time of the, I mean, closer time to the event. I mean, certainly you might be better off in terms of the investigative steps to interview the witnesses closer in time to the event than 20 years afterwards. So what is in that government conduct as well?
But in her statement, she says there were no witnesses. No one was there, is what
she
said.
She told other folks about this. She told Commander Pitts, I don't remember her maiden name.
Right.
She talked to a lieutenant commander, apparently within her student squadron. Wouldn't it have better? Isn't that potentially reckless conduct on behalf of the government to not investigate that at that time?
I don't believe it rises to the reckless aspect of that, no. Especially when, if you don't have her cooperation, you're not going to be able to go forward. So again, you know, the idea is not just this simple negligence or whatever. If we're going with egregious, that's a reckless disregard for his ability to mount an effective defense. And, Your Honor, I see my time is up. If I could briefly conclude.
You may.
Congress's determination that rape will have no statute of limitations displays how extremely important that the prosecution of these cases are in our society, and this indefinite statute of limitations allows the government the ability to take its most serious cases to trial when it believes it has evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Those details, those principles are detailed by the Supreme Court in Lovasco. Given the significant congressional interest in the case, the enactment of federal and military rule of evidence 513, the passage of the Crime Victim Rights Act, a victim's willingness to participate in the criminal justice system is a driving factor in this legislation, and also why rape has remained on the very short list of crimes with no statute of limitations. In short, a victim's participation is undeniably paramount in these cases, whether it's in 1998 or today. So here we have a military judge's ruling that calls an SJA, quote-unquote, much more egregious because he honored a victim's wish to not pursue litigation and derided that SJA because he did not force her to testify. It's also a ruling that took issue with a victim's ability to, quote-unquote, pick and choose on when to participate in a case, which runs wholly against the law and public policy as well. Further, his ultimate conclusions were in error. His findings of fact were clearly erroneous, and when reviewed de novo, he committed legal error by finding a due process violation. Appellant suffered no prejudice. He was able to mount an effective defense. There was no substantial prejudice by the actions in this case, and the government engaged in no intentional and certainly no egregious delay. And as such, this court must overturn the military judge's ruling. There's no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.